This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The project String, Moscow Diary of Walter Benjamin, started several years ago as a parallel program, as an itinerant project. So what does it mean? It means that it's meant to be mutating, that it's meant to be changing and transforming unexpectedly. And we started as a parallel program of the Moscow Biennale of Contemporary Art with series of events, series of groundbreaking talks in Moscow. Then it mutated towards Princeton, Philadelphia at Slot. As a checkpoint, we had a significant, a very, very cool, actually, exhibition with fantastic diagrams and extracts of visual formulas from Moscow Diary made by Evangelos, and also the contribution of the students of Columbia University, who made a significant research by extracting some cultural statistics from this amazing phenomenon that we... that is called the Moscow Diary. I would remind you very briefly that Moscow Diary is practically the only document of Walter Benjamin that has been absolutely absent from censorship and even the inner censorship, and that was really attracts us. So it's kind of a territory, it's kind of this virgin territory of thought, and an entirely different modality of thought where we can trace some invisible lines that in the future would grow into something more, also because it's free of censorship. So Walter Benjamin was traveling to Moscow December 1926, freezing cold, absolutely mute, unprepared. He was searching for... He was longing for the new life of the new men, of the Soviet men. He was wishing to find his love, Asya Lasic. He was longing for the new faith in communism. What else? There were three or four, wishing points, and none of them actually were fulfilled. However, when Benjamin is returning back to Berlin from Moscow, the first line he writes is that Berlin is dead. So during his stay in the freezing cold, slippery, absolutely unreadable city fabric of this weird, exotic city, there was a point there of non-return for Benjamin, yeah? And we are reading this metanoia, this watershed of thought of a thinker as a particular prism. Yeah? Me and Evangelos were looking at the architectural prism, we're looking at the methodological prism, we're also looking at the potentiality of the Moscow Diary as a toolbox and what kind of cultural tropes and formulas we can extract from it in order to translate, as Ksenia once said, pasts into futures, and that we can, how we can articulate futures today. So for us, this document literally serves as a navigator, as a compass, yeah, in contemporary cultures. Maybe we can. One more moment. So behind us. Is a series of works of a fantastic artist, Moscow-based artist, Olga Chernyshova. She is one of the very rare cases who was Russian Soviet artist who is constantly present at the Venice Biennales and documenters and major museums. The series of works is called Anabiosis Fisherman Plant, and I would remind you that anabiosis is a particular state, biological state, where the breathing is suspended. When life is suspended, it's kind of blocked in order to preserve the future life. It is tightly connected with the concept of Russian cosmism, of preserving, of prolonging life, with the questions of immortality. And here we have this rapt images, the images of wrapped plants, that is a study case in itself. So the series of works is called Fisherman Plants. What does it mean? It means that there are two species, in dialogue, fisherman and plant. Fisherman is referring to the very particular state of the Russian fishermen during the winter time. I think it's quite a phenomenon when there is this obsession to sit in the frozen, waters and to wait for a fish to come out from this hole in ice, wrapped in several layers of plastic or fabrics, kind of suspended breathing, waiting for some miracle to come. And over time, she developed this trajectory, how to overlap it with the idea of preserving plants during the winter. Yeah, that during the winter, these precious plants, especially exotic plants, like palm trees, are usually wrapped in these layers of fabric in order to suspend the future potentialities and future miracles to come.
So thank you, Zinya, and thank you again to Art in General for being such a welcoming and wonderful partner on this evening's program. So as Zinya had mentioned, this project has followed a rhizomatic model of discourse. It's moved across geographies and institutions, but fundamentally it's also moved across disciplines. And at the heart of this project is the notion that any reading of Moscow Diary should not belong to one discipline or one sensibility, but rather everybody who participates adds new perspectives, and that enriches the project, but also in a way is a testament to the richness of Moscow Diary itself. At the heart of the project is, on the one hand, a historical reading of the diary that recognizes how much Benjamin teaches us about history. At the same time, it also uncovers and helps us navigate the complex interplay between history and human subjectivity and individual subjectivity. So that would be one, in a way, aspiration of the project, right? To broadly engage the diary to read the diary insofar as it teaches us about history. On the other hand, there's kind of a second approach that we've taken, which is that it's actually silly to only read the diary as a historical document, right? Or as a document that enables historical understanding. That it is, at the same time as it's a historical document, it's also incredibly contemporary, and that it is a manual or a toolbox that can help us negotiate the present. Right? And so that's, I think, one of the aspects of the project that departs from maybe other readings of Moscow Diary. Again, we see this as an incredibly useful and empowering tool to navigate the current crises, as you had alluded to. So with that, I think
like the politics of land as well, yeah? How do we negotiate the politics of land today?
And this condition that I think kind of our title alludes to, which is that of feeling out of joint, whether internally alienated from ourselves, or whether alienated from others, or even from institutions, or perhaps political systems and structures. I think that challenge that Benjamin is grappling with, that process of kind of not feeling like he has a home and a place and where he belongs, is, I think, something that, again, we are reading both historically and in a contemporary vein. So we've spent much of the afternoon, and even on Monday we met as well, trying to debate how to begin this conversation. In a way, many of us, all of us, have already been in this conversation in Moscow and elsewhere, and we still haven't quite figured out how to begin. But one of the things that Ksenia had suggested was that we begin in a very personal way, speaking to the urgency of the diary, the way that the diary really resonates for us with something that we consider to be both important and essential. So you had suggested I go first, so I'm going to jump in. So 2 years ago when I had visited Moscow for this project with Zinya, I was trying to follow Benjamin's footsteps, and all of us have in different ways done this. But I was trying to kind of see Moscow as Benjamin wrote about it. And one of the things that was like very clear and palpable to me was because the time that I visited kind of mirrored Benjamin's time, and that it was in December, right, in the kind of the most austere and cold moments of winter. It was kind of, I understood how much the climate was registering in Benjamin's diary, and how much he was, in a very embodied way, attentive to the coldness. Not just climatologically, but also politically. Right? This is a moment of revolution, and he's trying to figure out what his place is in that society. And so I wanted to just throw that out there, this kind of this winter moment that Benjamin like travels to Moscow during, and it echoes in a way Olga's images, right? This sense of coldness and austerity, this sense of survival being very much on one's mind, the sense of kind of being incredibly alone in a sense. And again, I think that's something that we have to hold on to in our readings of the diary, because I think it also mirrors the times that we're living in right now.
That Benjamin has this wonderful phrase in his diary that to know at a square in any city, you have to enter it at least four times from all the different streets that leads to it. Otherwise, you don't know the square. You can't experience the square until you. It suddenly all the time jumps onto it, and you are our square today. So, but basically, what I wanted to
congratulations.
Say.
Congratulations!
Yeah, you are the square. One of the things in Benjamin, which is quite important, which probably echoes the time we are living in now, is he's actually coming and echoes the idea of a disjoint territory. Because he comes to the place where he feels that it is part of an international scene. Basically, the same group of people would be discussing the same matters back in Berlin, back in New York, back in Zurich, and back in Moscow. It's the same kind of scene. On the other hand, this coldness you're talking about is a sign for him that the territory begins to sweep away. It's sort of it's farther from you than you expect, because it's very hard to enter it, even physically and emotionally. That's one thing. And the second thing, he actually experiences, that's what we talked about today, right at the left-wing revolutionary culture, with all the names of Merchold, Tairov, all the best avant-garde writers and painters whom for many years whose names would be for many years known in America and in Paris much better than in Russia itself, because we would never be given access to the names he mentions, and for him those names would be and everybody's currency at the time. But it is exactly the moment, 1926, when the first political process started, when Trotsky is already under pressure, when there is a common front formed, that he's a witness to it, against Merchold and the experimental Russian theater. And it's exactly the moment when he's a witness how this revolutionary culture that was actually uniting Russia to the rest of the world was breaking, and he's a witness of something that would be gone just for that moment. Because in a couple of 2 years' time, there will be a completely different scene, the names will be obliterated, and you wouldn't even find the traces. And that I think, is a very important thing of a moment of disjoint, a moment of cracking, like a whole continent is sweeping away from the rest of the world. Knowledge-wise, name-wise, reference-wise, anything-wise. And I think this is the moment when he fixes, and this cold functions in a very interesting way. It's both because, as we discussed, this cold has moments when the winter suddenly puts down. It was an amazingly warm day, and Moscow became close. So he actually, through that moment, through that passage of his, and the same thing happens with the woman he loves. She's a completely the muse of the revolution, the kind of destructive female character you meet in the Brick Sisters, in Gala for Salvador Dali. Arcelaches is this kind of revolutionary Russian woman, everybody, or Sabina Spielrein. It's the same kind of strain of women that now feel the scene. And the same kind of warmness and coldness is with the lies within the relation of the woman, with the woman, who is not necessarily, who's expecting and then rejecting all the time. And he doesn't, and it all comes, the line is like maddening heartbeat. So it's close and far, and close is warm, and far is cold. So it's, if you look at this, the text becomes multi-layered and even it strangely constructed in particular ways. Probably we will talk about, there are several lines of strain along the, that's where I wanted to jump in. And I think that that's what we're experiencing in a way now, because perhaps we're witnessing that the whole continent of knowledge and of life is probably becoming now, we are witnessing the point when it will be cracking and the world will awaken in a couple of months' time will be very different. And all the names will be gone, all the references will be gone, and everything you, it can happen. And so I think this is kind of, and in this way, it's amazingly courageous how he experiences this moment, that he doesn't turn his eyes away and he goes into that territory, although it's painfully killing to him.
Moment of cold, what the moment you're talking about?
Moment of cracking, yeah, and it's going to disjoy. That's,
you know, that's a particular prophecy, actually, because 2 years ago, when Aaron was traveling to Moscow, Aaron was coming from the Democratic West, and it was a completely different politics of land and a completely different, you know, discursive platform. I was kind of preparing Aaron that Russia is now in a particular stage of political negotiations, and after 2 years, here we go, in preparation for this talk, Aaron reminded me, you know what, I think I start to read our background with Moscow Diary in a particular prism in terms of politics of land, what happens with us today here on this continent, in this country. So we kind of can use this absolutely sincere, intimate document. This intimate document rescales all over the sudden towards territories, lands, political systems, dictatorships, I would even say. Yeah. So as a tool, as a prism.
Yeah, we also had this fantastic conversation on the cafe couch a few minutes ago about, you know, like what Benjamin perhaps anticipates might be following from this cold winter, right, and this diagnosis of a cold universe, right? And we had this fantastic conversation about whether this winter will be followed by a winter that's even more cold, or whether somehow it will begin to thaw, and maybe a spring will arrive, but that spring will of course result in the melting of everything that he's read and he's tried to diagnose in Moscow at that time.
Also, we talked how to start, yeah? So it was my idea just to share for each of us a short introduction to the topic, or what is it, Moscow Diary of Benjamin, and what is it, disjointed territories, yeah? And it will be impossible for us to say the same things, yeah?
No.
Well, and concerning mine approach to Moscow Diary, Benjamin's Moscow Diary, it's absolutely amazing text, because it's very intimate, very sincere text, and it's the result of encounter of other reality, yeah? So he's not a bad professional high-brow critics in Moscow in December 26, January 27, but gives us a clue to his more elaborate text, yeah, where he knows the play and he can show what he wants and hide what he doesn't want to show, yeah. And in Moscow Diary, according to strange coincidence, we see, okay, the inner fabric of his observation techniques, of his description techniques, And this moment, 2 months long moment, did happen in a very strange moment of development of Russian Revolution 1917, when the revolution came to get frozen, yeah? Coming back to some personal experience of the topic where the text of Moscow Diary is important, yeah? So now we have 100 years anniversary of Russian Revolution 1917, and in some enigmatic way there is so much obscurity what to say about this event, and I guess not only in Russia but quite worldwide. And in this situation of 2017 we are not far from the situation of Benjamin of 1926. A revolution did happen, but Benjamin is watching not the solid results of that revolution, meaning the results of military revolution, a result of workers' revolution, a result of peasant revolution, a result of political revolution. What he sees is revolutions of background, side effects of that big revolution, meaning side effects, cultural revolution, a revolution of everyday life. Mm-hmm. And opposite to that big results of October revolution of 1917, that gets in the way, in the process, kind of alienated, yeah, mm-hmm. and distracted by the process, the revolutionary process itself. That revolution, cultural revolution, a revolution of everyday life, did persist, yeah, and did stay with us through the documents of that epoch, documents of art and documents of diaries of other persons, documents of literature, and exactly that moment are delivering to us by the diary, Moscow Diary of Benjamin. He shows us the real revolution that happened and not the imaginary revolution that in some mysterious or not mysterious way gets into a dead end. That's interesting and very actual for us, yeah.
But in fact, in this way, he becomes very close in his writing to great Russian classical avant-garde writer Andrei Platonov, who at the same time writes his famous Pit, which is actually to show the kind of disjoint space of a pit, and basically very close in the description to Benjamin's Moscow, which is an enormous cold, strange object, not really a city. But I wanted to say to you, one of the first phrases also he writes that I have a new, there is a new sight when he comes to Berlin, new optics, and it reminds you like once you come back to Moscow, you acquire a new new optics, which is very parallel to acquiring like new spiritual sight, vision. And I think that one of the things I was bringing into discussion, which I think is very important, everything else Benjamin writes, he's famous for writing in fragments. But Moscow Diary is the only actual writing what has the beginning, the end, and the culmination. It starts with him arriving, and it ends with him leaving the place and coming to Berlin. It's actually the only looped. It's actually the only full piece of work that exists. And in that piece of work, you find the traces of everything else that he's going to do without mentioning Moscow experience. So he acquires this new vision in Moscow and comes back with it to look at Europe, to look at Marseille, to look at Paris, to look at the everyday life of bourgeoisie, to look at everything, but from that hidden basis, which Ksenia was talking about, censored. Of course, he delivers the text, he was prepaid. He writes Moscow, like because Martin Buber asked him for his magazine to write the text. And in the diary, you can see the paragraphs, which he actually just shifts. But
these are fragments. But Moscow Diary, within the fragments of Benjamin's later work, it's that piece of the puzzle which you put in, and then the picture becomes close. Picture becomes evident. For example, I'll give you an example. He will be discussing Paris. But where, what is the optics of seeing Paris, which he finds in Moscow? He walks through the coldest Moscow, and then comes to a place where is a gallery where Russian millionaires, they were, as you know, collecting French Impressionist work. Like the first big collectors of French Impressionist works were Brother Shusev and Shukin, and he sees two paintings that are facing each other on the, after the cold, after Asya saying no, after, and he sees these two streets. Streets of Paris by Pissarro and Cézanne. No, Pissarro and, sorry, who else is there? Oh, Manet. And one street is two men looking, it's given through the angle of two men looking through the balcony, and this, it's a very odd angle. And the one and the other is through the leaves. So it's not the frontal view, it's this kind of new...
Shifted
view through which you, and then he would get the deserted streets of Paris in Paris in his work on photography. He starts seeing through seeing there, but what is important is the first thing that is the ground of your study, of your research, is the thing you get on your skin. It is things that get on yourself. Unless that, you will be sliding over the surface, but you will never get that very strong existential shift, and very, he knows his vision is sharpened by the experience in Moscow. That's, and there are many places, if you, because I was reading, probably I was lucky enough, because first text I read were never Moscow Diary. It was actually Ksenia, she pushed me into reading Moscow Diary. I sort of read it, but I was interested, as everybody else, in other texts. But then when we started reading Moscow Diary together and discussing, I suddenly realized that I see those texts right there. That's when it happened. That's where it happened. And so this optics, I think, is very interesting to decipher. And the second thing is how he... We were discussing the disjoint, and for me disjoint is not two territories that are disjoint, but just as you said, the Moscow as a disjoint territory. So it's a territory without paths. Benjamin comes in the time when Europe knows no paths. It doesn't. The old paths don't work. 19th century paths don't work. Everybody in Russia says, we know where to go. We know where to play. Where's the future? Because he actually comes at the time where individual research independent position is being subdued by to the will of the party. You have to discuss before you make any individual judgment. You have discussed with the party what's the party's position to that, because party knows the truth. And so he wanders between the European torn paths that are leading dead ends, not leading anywhere, and he goes along the big path, which he doesn't understand, because for him it's also a dead end. So it's also like two dead ends. In Marseille Diaries, in his architectural work, what will he be looking at? At the construction of dead ends. Ghetto. That's what you were talking about. So this, what he does is that he is not judgmental, but he takes it as a new it's phenomenon you have to look into. That's what I'm saying. Because Moscow Diary is not about the critique. It's about acquiring a new vision at the worst pain. The hardest things to look at are the moments of the future. Because basically we can read in two ways any given moment. It's the end of something past, and there is a great discourse of end, ending everything, ending of Europe, ending
lost,
etc. But the same thing we can read at any moment as the beginning, as the beginning of the future. And Benjamin's role in that is amazing. In fact, that we are ourselves the proof that he was reading the future but not the past. Because many people who are writing at the same time, like Adorno and Horkheimer, like in many ways Martin Heidegger, many people who are writing at that time, Now they are very prominent, we like to read them, but they are part of the ending wave. They are part of history now. What we read in Benjamin, we read ourselves. And that means that he was deciphering, and at the time he was basically quite unknown author, unappreciated by the contemporaries, whose work was not that important for anybody, but and whose work became important, more gained importance, since the time of his death. And each generation began to read more and more, which means he was more and more actual. And we are now sitting here and discussing not even the texts that are actual, like photography. Where we came finally, which is, I think, a very good place to start with, we came to Moscow Diary, where he deciphers that new future through himself, through his own body and his own body architecture for his own skin. But basically, he looks... And that's why I suddenly understood how that you have to, for example, this beautiful, absolutely beautiful thing, how he sits in this hotel. I will just shut up in a second, but I discovered that recently. He sits in the hotel and he says it's by the end of his journey. It's a desperate journey. It's this I would prompt you to read his three-page little article, Destructive Character. It's an amazing article on the historical force of a destructive character, but once you read it, you realize he's writing about Asia. And she becomes an architectural force, a historical force, how he describes what it is, the human destructive character. And again, this is painful, this is bad, sort of destructive character. We may immediately label that as bad. But in fact, he finds a strange way of praising it. At many points it makes me shiver because it like so much brings you to this strange mysticism of seeing God's work even in the destruction. So there is kind of his friend Scholem, he was not for nothing his friend, but he sits in the hotel and he sits, suddenly says, "I begin to understand the sounds." And he describes everything. He describes how people are walking. And I know where they're walking because the child's voice talking on the phone. And suddenly he begins to understand how the social cosmos of the hotel he lives in works. So he understands what people are doing. And he's sitting in that room and he says, it's the best room where I can write. I never worked anywhere better than in Moscow. And I was thinking, why? Because he's given so much attention to the bourgeois rooms. So what is a bourgeois room? It's a room with comfort. It's a room that has lots of pillows, everything is there. And he says, how we pay for this comfort? We pay with melancholy. And he says that the center of the bourgeois comfort is piano. And he wanted to make this, and they had this brilliant conversation as to how to speak about piano. How can we speak about piano as the center of melancholy in the room? But basically, in that hotel, he sits in the piano because he sits in that room and he hears the sounds. But the sounds are different, and I think why? Because actually, this is not a bourgeois room, because these are the sounds of social cosmos. And sitting in the room, he feels attached through discomfort to all those things that are happening. A child running to the phone. Oh, I know this is a child from the other. And here is the heavy steps. Aha, here's the guy who brings the wood for the fire. So he knows already, and he only has to listen. And at that point, he feels safe in the middle of social cosmos in his room. And that's where he writes best. And that's where he writes his diary. And I think these are amazing moments of this universe he was looking for. Because he basically, what he did, he went beyond the stage. If Europe is a bourgeois stage, bourgeois theater of total comfort, he had to break the wall. And Asya was the destructive force that just broke the wall in the theater. And he followed to what happens behind that to find the traces. And I think now, we for the first time, can be specifically attentive to things that happened to him in while he wanders through that uncharted territory where there are no paths, where basically he, you know, what he notices is a perfect thing, as Xenia was more than once referring to, that because of the ice there is no difference on the between the pavements and the where and the and the sidewalk walks. The ice destroys the this kind of break, and what every moment everything he's attentive to is the phenomenon, even if it seems like he's, I don't know, he's taking a toy in his hand. That's not what that, it's like being in a dream, and Moscow is like the strange dream where everything is a sign because you can't read them.
There's a lot of things, you know, I so much agree with you, and one of the things you said earlier, the idea of acquiring a new vision after reading Moscow, a kind of new epiphany almost in reading the city. And, you know, as somebody coming from an architectural background, Benjamin is somebody who is as a very astute observer of the modern metropolis, the Western metropolis. That's how most of us got to know his work, you know, through the Arcades project, Paris, and everything else. And because, you know, through Xenia's seminar also at Columbia, I learned about the existence of the Moscow Diary. And, you know, I was just very interested in reading it out of, you know, personal curiosity because I happened to be writing on the Soviet Union. But in a way, the fact that the diary is about Moscow is kind of incidental, I would say. So I think it's an amazing document in itself. It's a great coincidence for us interested in Moscow that it happens in Moscow. But as Susan Barkmore says very beautifully and pointed, I think, it's the eastern point of Benjamin's compass. So if Paris represents the west, and Naples, where he travels the year before, is the south of the Mediterranean, and Berlin is the north, Moscow definitely is the most eastern point that helps complete the coordinates of his thinking about the contemporary city. So in that sense, it's kind of like the puzzle piece that you need to put in place in order to understand the rest of his vision. And that's, you know, since the very beginning, one of the things he does consistently through the book is that he constantly compares what he experiences in Moscow with other cities, with Marseille, with Paris, with Berlin. And he writes that one gets to know Berlin through Moscow. And, you know, there's always this benchmark, whether the telephone lines are better here or there, or this service or the other. So it becomes a kind of orientation device for him, you know, in lack of a different metaphor. And to go back to the idea also of the disjointed experience or disjointed territory, first of all, Benjamin is an amazing writer, and that, you know, he reveals things and under a new light, you know, when you read. But he's also very much into the future all the time, and that's why I think we will find some kind of resonance with the present moment. And in a way, after our conversation, I started thinking that disjointedness that comes after his Moscow Diary, which is the last linear kind of writing he does, the fact that he's convolutes for the Arcades project is written in this kind of indexing system that can be rearranged, decomposed, it can be scattered here and there, it can be put in boxes, reshuffled. It kind of anticipates, you know, the fragmentation of experience and space that postmodern theorists, described in the 70s and 80s. So he's kind of even going beyond the modern experience, which is all about the analog, linear, tape reading of the world. And just also before on Oleg's request to have a kind of more personal note. First of all, you know, it's interesting for me because that's the first time I'm in a conversation with this wonderful group. But it's even more interesting to have, like, as I asked the other day, what's the experience of three Russian speakers or natives of Moscow reading such a document versus someone like Aaron, who, you know, is American, I guess? And somebody who's a Greek national, you know, a contested area, which for the latter, you know, the better part of the second part of the 20th century, was a contested territory, whether it go under the influence of Soviet Union or the US. So for me, it's kind of this oscillation again and a kind of orientation device to be in this between these two things. And I happened to read the Moscow Diary after I visited Moscow, also arriving in a sleeping car in Moscow. So you wake up in this kind of half-dreamy state and you're trying to make sense of the new city that you first encounter. And to quote Michael Jackson, I also felt like a stranger in Moscow in many ways. For Benjamin, it's like an indecipherable environment, and that's what really makes all his senses and embodied experience very astute and sharpened, and paying attention to all kinds of layers of modernity that constitute the city or not.
I think it's very nice, but it wasn't that nice for Benjamin, because the tragedy, like what you're saying, about trying to join in, you were not trying to join in Moscow City. Benjamin desperately tries to belong. That's what you were talking about, right?
Yeah, he's like incredibly hungry to find compassion and to belong, whether to the revolution, to Asia, we've already mapped out
to modernity.
To modernity, yeah. To cultural institutions, right? Like one of the things that many of us have been interested in, how almost every encounter he has with a cultural institution is totally disappointing for him. Right? Either the doors are closed when they're supposed to be open, or the person he's meeting isn't there, or the kind of cultural mode of production is totally sentimental and spectacular and ill-equipped to help you navigate the present. It's amazing, like how the diary charts constant disappointments, like this hunger to belong, this hunger to find a sense of belonging, whether institutionally or personally or politically, and a constant sense of alienation might not be the right word, but incredible frustration. And I think the diary, as you've taught me to read the diary, is this incredibly potent tool for him to negotiate that frustration, to document it, to register it, but also to work through it psychologically, I think.
I would jump in with a small remark on the power of invisible that is incredibly present in the diary. It's the power, is the discourse of visible-invisible that became the core platform for the architectural theory of the 20th century, that was also the ground for, or the basis for the theory of porosity, because Benjamin, as we know, is the author of discrepancies, thresholds, gaps, or pauses, spaces in between, disjoints, that all the invisible territories that are twisted into the most important traces. Yeah, and the theory of porosity, the theory of threshold gaps in architecture for the 20th century is one of the core stones. However, he is constantly obsessed with the unified cosmos of Moscow. Yeah, he's constantly obsessed with repeatedly, present metaphors and tropes such as ice crust, snow that is shackling everything, and by shackling everything and making everything invisible or the traces invisible, it unifies. Yeah, following Bachelard's expression that the winter cosmos is the simplified cosmos. Yeah, and I would just rest here for a second. So, what is snow today in contemporary artistic practices and for theory of architecture, as well as for the Russian citizens, yeah? Because coming from the country of eternal frost, snow happened to be a tiny bit more than a line in the meteorological forecast. Yeah, it has the widest and the wildest range of connotations, from disaster, from death, from Argos, from the edge of the world, up to the mana, the mystery, the miracle, something that survives, that helps you to survive in the cold universe. Because only under the snow you can preserve life or future lives. Thinking snow in terms of cultural and political future, present and past, starts to be really vibrant in Russia, even today, even more probably. And thinking snow also in terms of instability, ephemerality. And I would remind you that Russia in the Soviet Union is probably the only state where the entire political system is articulated within this temperature scale, like the thaw period of the Brezhnev period. Yeah, it's a solid political term.
It's right there in the DNA of political system. And it's quite a phenomenon that it, we can also read, actually, and we can extract from Benjamin's observation. So for many years, the entire country used to be a huge refrigerator, as we know. And what I'm talking about is the prophecy that we can find in the diary, all these formulas and all these tropes that we're trying to withdraw, to extract, and to overlap, and to try to read the contemporary through this prism. Yeah.
One could look at the snow literally. So when Benjamin says, for example, that the snow covering the streets and the sleigh sliding on it, makes Moscow the most quiet city in the world. So the sonic scape of the modern metropolis is very different than that of Paris or Berlin. But for me, it was also it's fascinating how, again, the temperature becomes a metaphor for many other things. And one of the phrases that caught my attention is where he writes that space literally changes according to whether it is hot or cold.
That's powerful.
This one metric of the environment can determine the lived experience on the immediate, area of your own body, but also in a kind of social situation, and that can even, apply to a whole territory or, relationships with other territories. And that's the beauty in a lot of Benjamin's writing, that, you read something like that, and it goes much further beyond the actual thermometer in the world.
So the snow is the sign of defeat of civilization of the city. And promise of the new beginning. It was my question to you, you described that experience of Benjamin. Don't you think that the Kinderzimmer, child room image could describe that longing of Benjamin in Moscow, but feeling that mood to feel yourself for Benjamin in Moscow, Kinderzimmer,
the first time we talked, we traveled and endlessly talk about Benjamin. So the first time we talked about him in Russia, I compared Moscow Diary to Nutcracker. So the traveling along, it's Christmas time, it's he collects all the time this toys, children's toys, and it's like a big, really big room for a child. Moscow, he pays attention to this kind of very bright moments, some Mongols, some babushkas, you can put that on the Christmas tree and travel in between. But you asked about snow, and Ksenia mentioned in a very different way. What's something I wanted to come back to and answer to you about fragmentation? Because yes, we loved fragments. And in the 60s, 70s, 80s, postmodern culture, it's all about fragments. But the problem of postmodern culture is that there is fragments missing that makes it a whole. And with Benjamin, exactly, he's trying to find something, what is unifying. The moment he sees, he says, that he says that this idea of a person, the person you love, the face of the person you love close by, makes the world whole. So there's a missing fragment, and that's why we're defragmented. There is always a missing, what makes it whole. And
every time he's on the cusp of identifying or reaching or accessing this fragment, of course he finds himself more out of joint.
Exactly. But finding himself more out of joint, he finds more phenomena to describe. Which alienate him and makes this kind of metaphors, this kind of sentences that have such a long span into the future that they amaze you now. But I think, because I'm extremely frustrated and interested how these sentences work, why they hit from 1926, you find some sentences that hit back to you in 2017. How does this work? Many texts that we find very authoritative, very important for our studies, they don't work this way. And I was, I just wanted to, probably in a kind of very dramatic and literary fashion, but I'm a writer, bring you back to the moment Benjamin dies. And he dies in a very particular way, and I think this is a death right from Moscow Diary. He dies on the because he's on the flight from fascists in the Pyrenees. He's with a group of Jews that try to escape from France, where everybody gets arrested, to Spain, where they don't arrest Jews. And he understands completely what's going on. The fact is, Jean Darnaud, the French guys, they don't quite get it. And the Jews have no way of explaining what is going on, because it was not obvious that the horror is there. And the funny thing is, I just noticed this time that just before last pages of Moscow Diary, and in 2017 it reads like a blow, that he looks at the monastery of Russia and says, it's beautiful, just like in Assisi, but more, it reminds me of Dachau. And when you read Dachau in Moscow Diary, you know how he died, it's like it begins to, that's what I'm saying, like self-fulfilling prophecy, it's written. And he either commits suicide or he dies out of heart attack, never known. But because of his death, everybody else gets passed. It's such a powerful thing it defines the death of a person in many ways defines the way he lived. And the fact of this awareness, and we have to also know that the major part of his documents, unpublished, lies in French library with Georges Bataille, and it was the only manuscript. So he's not the famous Benjamin we're talking about. It's some guy dying on the in the proof. And I think that Moscow Diary, in a way, and this is the missing piece. So what is the missing piece? But and at this point of our development, as why we're able to come to Moscow Diary, which is probably the missing piece. We are looking for integrity. The fragmentation, the construction out of fragments, is we've done all that, and our problem is not how which beautiful fragments we can juxtapose, but what is the missing piece? Like you said, the invisible. What makes it whole? And I think that this is something that is inscribed. And in the way he dies, it's very much like a phenomenon from Moscow Diary. This is such a powerful statement that everybody else, and he's the missing piece, because he doesn't pass, but what he did makes everybody else, saves everybody else. And I think that Benjamin, in a way, was able to create or witness the kinds of modernity that, unlike old Europe, unlike totalitarian Germany, and unlike a totalitarian Soviet Union, that kind of modernity that really was there in the dark, missing, and was going into the future. Although everybody else was saying, we know where the future is. But that kind of future, you can never make a state into it.
I worry that this is becoming a seminar in a historical understanding of Benjamin. So I want to ask each of you to speak to kind of the other register of this conversation, which is the politics of adaptation that we find in Benjamin, but that we each in our own lives and intellectual frameworks finds him useful, right, to engage. So could any of you or all of you speak to
or also the audience,
and
probably.
Audience, yeah, and maybe we could even speak to this and then open it up afterwards.
Yeah.
But could we speak to, again, how Benjamin helps us think about the politics of adaptation today?
Well, I don't know whether I'm answering your question or just continuing.
Well, this adaptation, how to be Benjamin is not to adapt.
But coming back to the situation of Benjamin in 1926, he refuses from academical career, or academicians do refuse to accept him. Yeah, this path is closed, and he's coming to Moscow for the Christmas. It's a Christmas trip.
But also for the Communist Party, but he refuses that.
Yeah. You talked about hunger for engagement, but he's always skeptical about that moment. Should he take the mandate or not? So he refuses from the political engagement there. Yeah? There is parallel story with Gershon Shalem, with the question of religious engagement, but he was distanced from this person's way, and what he did find in Moscow, well, it's my case, it's a new techniques of dreaming up, yeah? New techniques to dream the reality up, yeah? So, and that's quite a strong weapon, quite a strong technique, and it's not corrupted with metaphysical or political predispositions. That's why that initial document stays actual for us, yeah? How to dream the reality up against the actual in consequences, incongruences of what happening on around us.
Yeah,
that's the way.
How to dream the future.
In the face of reality.
In the face of reality.
And against the reality.
And against it, yeah.
The most important invention of Moscow Diary for me, and this way to deal with reality, okay, says valid for us. It's not the most heroic attitude to the injustices that's happening around us, but it's the way to not get involved in doing that injustice. And that's already something. Point, yeah? Please contradict or approve.
I think we can provide various readings of this, yeah? Since we're in the space of art in general, it's probably worth mentioning that art is communicating to us today and how we respond to this and what were partially the optics of Benjamin that provides us. Coming back to the metaphor of snow, it's an incredibly contemporary metaphor. Looking at the recent Athens, Venice, Documenta, Manifesta, whatever, you name it, Art Basel, come on, the most, the business territory of art in general, we are still referring to the same powerful metaphors such as instability and snow and the spectrum, being locked in the spectrum of the visual apparatus, imply, however, all the metaphorical, metaphysical connotations are still there. So, for instance, why he is so obsessed with snow? And what is he withdrawing from the metaphor of snow? It's exactly the instability and the curiosity, what is under the snow, yeah? So this kind of melting effect, the effect of the edge. And that's what really interests and triggers me. So on the first glance, snow is like calming down, the way to escape political and social disorders and visual disorders. Yeah, it's the unifying mana, the unifying illumination and magic. On the other hand, there is always this uncanny experience, like what is under the snow, what would happen when it melts down. And it speaks to us, yeah, on the level of contemporary art, on the level of the discourse of contemporary art and architecture. So it's a zone of total contemplation, of nothingness, the zone that doesn't cover only the material world of objects. So there is always this borderline, talking of politics of lands, borders, territories, watersheds, you know, frontiers. There is always this edge. So that was probably the most intriguing for me. I don't know, for you, Evangelos, what was it?
Well, there's so many. I mean, you know, it's hard to pinpoint one. But I would say, I think, you know, for me, the idea of the acute awareness brought by being a very astute observer as an outsider is very interesting. And also the idea that, you know, It's very much a story of disenchantment in many ways, going, you know,
yeah.
expecting certain things, believing that you know all you would know about a certain condition or a political regime or whatever, and finding out things that are not as you expected.
Yeah.
And I feel a lot of people, even on this side of the Atlantic, have gone through, you know, a similar situation recently, especially when you're within a certain context and social circle where certain things, you know, kind of return back to you and you feel, you know, in a kind of sphere that is kind of comfortable, or you
yeah.
think you're aware of
yeah.
all the hues and colors of
yeah.
the crying box. So for me, that is something that resonates very much. And, you know, the geopolitics might have changed, you know, in many different ways, but in a way there's also shiftings of similar patterns in other regimes.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch, you know, North Korea's announcements yesterday.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's not, let's say, mapping one-to-one all these, you know, oppositional tensions that one brings in the diary, but for me the idea of imagining what happens after this disenchantment, or being aware that it may happen, or you know, and it's an alertness, you know, in keeping a critical eye on
right.
Things that are beyond your own reality, in order to comprehend your own position.
Yeah, yeah. Probably we should get some questions from Ksenia. But I just want to involve the audience and then we jump in, or you want to?
I think for me, outside of what I was just saying, and every time reading is so different, and I'm grateful for the text, but I think it's a great feeling of gratitude. It's a feeling of gratitude because this diary preserved for me as a Russian. I'm not quite Russian by my blood, but I'm. For me, it's the preservation of exact connections, and it is amazing how a person could have done it in 2 months, of the time, which was a missing piece. And although people are talking about the time now and exploiting it and realizing that it's a cultural legacy and heritage, and there's a great market around it, but in fact, that he preserved exactly in a way it should be, all the unspoiled, all the ties, all the complexities, to which he fall back as an apartment, like preserving a DNA of the culture. And then, and you can come back to it, not through this diary, you don't come, you see what he was showing. I was grateful because he was showing me what would be Stalinistic ways out that were already haunting my childhood in the 70s, but what were the other connections and the ways, and so I could travel back and find myself back there, and then reconnect to Europe, to anything, to people who are talking immediately at the heat of the discussion, and I realized that the link that was broken, cultural link, wasn't broken because he preserved it in exactly the way all the connections work, until they were. And that was, and the only feeling I had when I read it was gratitude.
So fantastic. It means that we are talking now extensively on disjointed territories and we found the joint.
yeah. But the fact is that the truly contemporary thing is that until you don't, you never go as far as the most disjoint thing is, that's where the joint will be. That's I think, it's part of the concern, and this Marxist at the recent exhibition on Benjamin, which we visited all, there was this famous Marxist quote, which I think works really well here, that to be contemporary, you have to see the everything stable melt. It's when you see that things can melt, it's when you suddenly find the joint, because the joint is, you cannot expect, it's the unexpected, the joint. But that, and that's when it works. And I think the most important thing to be that joint.
Amazing.
I'll make maybe one final comment before we
close.
You know, there's this absolutely wonderful phrase in Moscow Diary that Benjamin uses, employs a few times, that I've long been fascinated by. He basically, in English, refers to those that have struggled to adapt to a changing society as has-beens. Right? And he uses this phrase, has-been, to talk not only about individuals who have not adapted with the revolution, but also institutions. And cultural institutions. And I think it's like this absolutely fascinating and wonderful phrase that captures what Benjamin is himself struggling with and what I think all of us are also struggling with in each in our own ways. It's this phrase of present, it's a present perfect continuous, which basically is a kind of a syntactical construction that describes a historical kind of experience that like extends into the present unchanged, right? So people that have like not changed with the revolution, their lifestyles haven't changed, their belief systems haven't changed, right? These are has-beens, right? And he's very dismissive of them, and he refers to them as, in a way, almost fossils, right, of a changing society. And I think, again, he, Benjamin, like in Moscow Diary, is trying to survive on the margins. He's trying to adapt, but in his own way that preserves his individuality. And it is for this reason that he has to, as you spoke to so beautifully, he has to refuse so many things. Right, because those would compromise his sense of individuality and his freedom as an intellectual, as maybe even we could think of him today as an artist. So I think for me, that's, again, another way in which the diary is incredibly potent in helping us think about these same challenges and the same questions. And insofar as we're in a cultural institution, and so many of us probably in this room are all connected in so many ways to cultural institutions, I think this is also a challenge that we need to think about on an institutional level. Not just how do we survive this crisis moment in this country and across the globe, but also how do our institutions help us navigate those moments and also adapt alongside us and help us adapt in that same vein.